East and one in the West, and that today when we talk about the collapse of the Roman Empire, we really mean the Western Roman Empire as the Germanic tribes moved in. The Eastern Roman Empire remained a political entity of some importance for another 1,000 years following the traditional date of the fall of the Roman Empire, that is to say, 476. However, today we don't usually call the Eastern Roman Empire by that name. We call it by, oddly enough, the former name of the capital of that empire. That is to say, we call it the Byzantine Empire, named for the city of Byzantium, which became, in Roman times, the city of Constantinople, which of course has become today Istanbul. In 527, Justinian became the Byzantine or Eastern Roman Emperor. He would have simply called himself the Roman Emperor, the last Latin-speaking emperor, by the way, in the history of the Eastern Roman Empire. And he ruled until 565. And he's important for many things, as we will see as we look at the story that he tells us in the canto. But let me suggest one particular contact he has with Dante's world. That in his attempt to win back the Western Roman Empire and therefore reunite it all again, he invaded and conquered, actually conquered twice because he lost it once, Italy, and set up a headquarters in Italy in the city of Ravenna. And today Ravenna is most famous because it was there that many of Justinian's most wonderful buildings were created and decorated with splendid mosaics, and many of them remain today that we see. Let's not forget that Dante, in the last years of his life, moved from Verona to Ravenna, where, in fact, in the various churches, two different mosaic portraits of Justinian survive. And therefore, this distant in time and distant in space Byzantine emperor, as we might think of him, was in fact quite proximate to Dante because, A, he was a Roman emperor and the Roman Empire still survives, albeit in truncated form, and B, Justinian was present politically, not personally, in the city where Dante wrote the Paradiso.
Justinian, as we said, only speaker in this canto, and he begins sort of by identifying himself, but he doesn't do it very concisely or very directly. He does it by sort of putting his place, his own place, in imperial succession out as the first thing he wants to talk about. And it's very interesting to see the language that he uses in order to do this. Once Constantine reversed the eagle's flight against the course of heaven, which it pursued behind that warrior who wed Lavinia, 100 and 100 years and more, the bird of God remained on Europe's edge, close to the mountains whence it first arose. Well, this is a pretty jam-packed bunch of lines. It suggests, first of all, that he sees himself in continuity with a story that begins all the way back with, you guessed it, Virgil's Aeneid, because the warrior who wed Lavinia is Aeneas. That was how the Aeneid ends. He defeats Turnus and therefore gets the hand of Lavinia. And so what Constantine does is take the course that Aeneas followed from Troy to Italy and reverse it by, as Bill suggested, moving the capital back east. The point, of course, being that Constantine's city, Constantinople, is close to old Troy. And notice that he also says this was against the course of heaven. In other words, the proper course of heaven is from east to west, and what you have with Constantine is sort of undoing that. But anyhow, he's saying, there it is. Now the center of power is back east, and then a couple of hundred years, and the little bird, that is to say, the Roman eagle, they're talking about, of course, the Romans using the eagle as their battle standard and using that as, therefore, the image of empire. The Roman eagle is back east, and when it's back east, he then comes to his own time, okay? Caesar I was, Justinian I remain. In paradise, office is not important, person is.
And he begins to tell us his story. And it begins this way. Justinian I remain, who, by the will of the first love I feel, purged all the laws of excess and of shame. We've already talked a little bit about the Justinian Code, as it's called, but it's worthwhile now fleshing that out a little bit because it's the first thing Justinian tells us about himself and his accomplishments. Basically, at Justinian's time, Roman law was a mess. There were so many different promulgations of emperors and so on that it was hard to know what was the really, right now, the law of the Roman Empire. And so what Justinian did is carried out a scholarly project that he gave to a number of people, not only to sort of organize the Roman law, clean it up, make sure that old repealed laws are out of there, but also included commentaries and a textbook so people could learn the law. And since Justinian was the last Latin-speaking emperor, this was all done in Latin. For several hundred years, the Code of Justinian was hardly known in the West because in the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West, it wasn't very relevant. But beginning in the 12th century, with the rise of city-states and national monarchies in Western Europe, all of a sudden people said, wow, this Justinian Code thing really is helpful to rulers today, whether it's rulers by board in Florence or by a king in England or France. And therefore, we need to use it and study it because it can be our guide. Such was true in Florence. And therefore, it is the Justinian Code that is the way we today know the value of Roman law. And remember, Dante has already said, Italy is especially shamed because we have good law, the Code of Justinian. We just don't have anybody to carry it out, to enforce it, because the emperor is away. So Justinian is, first of all, telling us about what probably historians today would agree was his most important and lasting achievement.
And he does this in a very interesting way, because as this was, you know, this was the great thing that I've done. How is it that I came to do this? How come I had, you know, I have this achievement on my belt, which others didn't? And it turns out that before he was able to do this, he had to get a whole bunch of other things right, and then was sort of prepared for what turned out to be historically, and of course, as he puts it, individually, his great job. Before I assumed this task, I thought that Christ had but one nature and no more, and I was satisfied with this belief. What he's telling us is, essentially, before I did this, I was a heretic, right, in Orthodox terms. But the blessed Agapetus, he who was supreme shepherd of God, directed me with his enlightened words to the true faith. It's interesting, he's saying, basically, the Pope straightened me out. Now, why would Justinian want us to know that particular fact?
Let's assume for a minute that we take this story as historical. There are some scholars who are not quite sure of the history of this. You cannot, in a sense, be a citizen, let alone a leader of the empire, if your faith is wrong. That this becomes a kind of prerequisite for Dante to write rule. That you can't sort of be wrong about the ultimate questions and still be real good at the other stuff. And that therefore, it is important that he get this right. And in doing so, he's also established what we would call today the proper relationship between church and state. Justinian is going to handle the legal business and its enforcement. The Pope is the one who guides people on the road to salvation. In fact, he says, I trusted him. That says something about Justinian. It also says something about the status of the papacy at that time. And what he knew by faith, I now see clear, meaning now that I'm in heaven, I see that he, in fact, got it right and taught me right. And had he not gotten it right and had he not taught me right, I'd be somewhere else.
So he says, got that out of the way. Next thing I had to get out of the way, to my Belisarius I gave my arms. For God's right hand so guided his, I knew it was a sign for me to rest from war. That is to say, he gives his general the sort of commission that he himself had been doing previously, again, as a kind of preparation for what he's going to do with the law. So he has established himself as lawgiver, but also established himself as somebody who knows the right relationship between spiritual and temporal, and also knows that the law ultimately turns out to be something more important than fighting and winning battles.
So he has established himself as the emperor of the Roman Empire by handing his arms to Belisarius to go get those parts of the empire which had been taken away by these Germanic tribes, Italy, parts of North Africa, even a little bit of Spain. He reconquered for what we would call the Byzantine, what he would call the Roman Empire. So he understands the nature of empire is this world rule that will bring peace. He understands that in order to do that, he needs the right faith, and he understands that you cannot administer an empire without law. You can't do it by fiat. You can't do it by ad hoc decisions. You need a basis in law. So he is, in fact, the great Roman emperor. But then his story flashes way, way back. He goes back to where he started in this canto. That is to say, he goes back to the time of the Aeneid, time of Aeneas, and carries the story forward through Roman Republican and Imperial history. This is extraordinarily important. For one thing, in doing it, he's sort of imitating the way Virgil tells the story of the Aeneid. Virgil begins in the middle, if you will, has these flashbacks and then carries the story forward. So we begin in the middle. With the reign of Justinian, we go back to the earliest times, and then later on in this canto, he will carry the story of the empire up to Dante's present. So he's not only retelling parts of Virgil's story, he's using a Virgilian technique.
And of course, just to say something that is both very obvious and very important, that retelling is a commentary on the original telling of Roman history that takes place in Book 6, of the Aeneid, so that we not only have Inferno 6 and Purgatorio 6 as the background here, as the kind of progression that we've suggested already about politics going from smaller to a wider canvas, we also have the whole background of Aeneid 6, and the fact is that he's now able to take that story and update it. And, of course, update it from two perspectives. Bill said, starting in the middle, and that's kind of nifty. He's starting sort of with his own time, then going back. Then, of course, when he pulls that story forward, he's able to talk about it in terms that Virgil couldn't, because, of course, Virgil's story ends with Augustus. So he has the story of how you get from Augustus to his own time. But remember, he also has all of the centuries between the time he lived and the time that Dante is taking the journey. So that what we have is a much wider canvas than was available to Virgil. And we have the continuation of this story. And this becomes, therefore, a very important way in which Dante the poet is rewriting the Aeneid. Rewriting the Aeneid from the perspective of a Christian Roman emperor.
In his retelling of some of Roman Republican history, he says this, "Under the eagle triumphed in their youth Scipio and Pompey, and it showed its wrath," the eagle that is to say, "against the hill beneath which you were born." In other words, this is a reference to a fairly obscure event in Roman history that involved the city of Fiesole, a little city on a hill right up above Florence. You can take the city bus up there today, in fact. And why would Dante mention such a trivial piece of Roman history, Dante, that is to say, the poet, through the mouth of Justinian, in this particular context? Because I think what Dante's doing here is reminding us of the flip side of something we've said probably 70 or 80 times. That is to say, that things that seem very private to us, whether we're talking about love or gluttony or whatever it might be, are in fact things that have public consequences. This is the other side of that, that this great big story, Dante, you're a piece of it. Your city's story, and therefore your story, are a part of it. And one of the things this allows Dante the poet to do is, later on, about 10 cantos later, we'll talk about this in a future lecture, when Dante hears the history of Florence told by his great-great-grandfather, Cacciaguida, that too is a continuation of the Aeneid. That too is a continuation and rewriting of Justinian's story, because what's personal to Dante is public. What's public in this great history of the Roman Empire, Dante, you and your city are a part.
In the next part of the story he tells, he continues the image of the flight of the eagle, and the eagle becomes the sign of the various victories of the Romans as we move from their early history into late Republican history and make the move from Republic to Empire. It's interesting that as part of that history, he relates to us stuff that we've already seen. He mentions, almost in passing, what happens with the figures of Brutus and Cassius, and in the process talks about the fact that, as we saw, Brutus and Cassius are, as he puts it, wailing in hell. Well, just a kind of footnote to the way in which Paradiso works, notice that it suggests that the folks who are here have a great deal more knowledge at their disposal than those that we've met in Purgatory or in Inferno. They know the grand sweep of history. They get to see, and presumably part of what it means to be in Paradiso is to see very broadly. And it's kind of neat that you have this footnote, okay, to what we saw at the very end of Inferno, and we now have a way of putting it in its larger context. We could say, well, okay, it's because they were going against the movement of empire that they are so guilty and that they deserve their place down at the bottom of hell.
Justinian also reminds us in that same passage, what were the very practical consequences back on earth of the assassination of Julius Caesar? Well, we know, we would say today, it was another round of civil war before Augustus finally triumphed. Dante puts it in much more powerful terms. It, this act of Brutus and Cassius, it made Modena and Perugia grieve. Two cities not too far away from Florence in somewhat different directions, but in fact, what we would call military atrocities occurred in the next round of civil wars in Modena and Perugia. Real people, lots of real people, died as a result of that assassination of Julius Caesar. So it has, again, many dimensions to it. It's sort of part of the great big story of Roman history, but it also reminds us that these great big sort of mega events, if you will, have very personal and, in this case, tragic consequences.
Now, again, he continues the story, but it's sort of interesting to see a big gap. He takes it all the way up to the first century and then jumps to Charlemagne. Whoa, what kind of a leap is that? First of all, we have to remember something that Bill said earlier in this lecture. He starts in the middle of things so that the centuries between them have at least been partially filled in by the story of Constantine and the story of his own work and his own accomplishments as emperor, so that it's not as big a jump as it seems to be. But the second thing to keep in mind is that for us, this seems a little bit weird because we don't necessarily think of Charlemagne as part of that same story of empire. For him, it most definitely is the same story, and that what Charlemagne was doing was really bringing the empire back to life, or bringing the empire back to life in the West, and it becomes part of the same narrative that Justinian is giving here.
We're so used to calling Charlemagne's empire the Holy Roman Empire. It sounds like it's a different political entity. We need to remember, Charlemagne didn't call himself that. Charlemagne was the Roman Emperor. And it's important to keep that distinction. Dante spends, that is to say, through the speech of Justinian, six whole lines on Charlemagne and the Carolingian reestablishment of the empire, and then makes another great big skip of several hundred years, more or less to Dante's own time. Against the public standard, that is to say, the eagle, once again, one group sets the yellow lilies. One claims it for its own party flag. And who knows which is worse? This is a description of the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. We're back to those political events that have so dominated so much of what Dante has discussed, because in his own day, you've got an emperor using the symbol of the eagle, but really a degenerate emperor. How do you know that? Not in Italy, not interested in being in Italy, off there in Germany. And then you've got the people who dare, this is the Guelphs, Dante's own party, to set their lily. Keep in mind the shape of that fleur-de-lis, that lily. It's sort of a kind of stylized eagle. They dare to set that against the empire. They're anti-empire. imperial. Remember, they're the pro-papal forces. So here, Dante is not condemning just Guelphs for being opposed to the empire or just Ghibellines for being degenerates of the empire. He's criticizing them both in the same tercet. The problem is not with one or the other. The problem is with both of the parties that are clamoring for power in Italy in Dante's own day.
I think that we could argue that that Guelph-Ghibelline bickering back and forth really starts in the Commedia in Inferno 6. Now what we do is see it, but see it in terms of the much larger picture, which puts it in context and shows how it's wrong in sort of cosmic and universal terms as well as local terms. And so simply to follow the narrative from Inferno 6, Purgatorio 6 to Paradiso 6 is all of a sudden to come to an understanding, an explanation for what is so base and what is so horrible about this Guelph-Ghibelline stuff.
That the context really is universal. Perhaps while Dante was writing the Paradiso, or more likely just before, Dante wrote a book called On World Government, De Monarchia, a book in Latin. And one of the arguments he makes in this book is that world empire is the most just form of government. Because if you have an emperor who's in charge of the world, it not only brings, of course, uniformity of law and whatever, but also there's no reason for that emperor to be greedy for power because he has the empire of the whole world. There's nothing to conquer, nothing to gain. And so Dante very much believes in the idea of empire. That helps us understand why Virgil, not just as poet, but as poet of the empire, is Dante's guide to start with. But it reminds us that these Guelph-Ghibelline struggles, which is sometimes sort of street fight by street fight and family by family in Florence, has, in fact, literally a universal dimension. This is part of the biggest story ever told politically, the story of the founding of Rome and the divine plan that God has for Rome as seat of empire and as seat of the church.
So this rewriting of Virgil, this rewriting of Roman history, which takes it all the way up to Dante's own time, ends, but it's interesting to see that it's not the end of what Justinian has to say in this canto. He moves from this universal picture to something which sounds a little bit more local, sounds a little bit more personal, because he wants to sort of tell about who else is here. Remember, they're in the sphere of Mercury, and he says, this little star, that is to say, Mercury itself, it's a small planet, is made more beautiful by valiant souls whose zealous deeds on earth were prompted by desire for lasting fame. Now, that's both a good news, bad news kind of thing, because it means that they were lacking a little bit in the hope that moves them quickly toward eternal things. But nonetheless, these are people who are glorying in the vision of God. They are all part of God's saved. And in a way, it's sort of appropriate because in some ways, you know, if you're kind of looking at this from the point of view of an astronomer, Mercury is sort of a hidden planet, if you will. It's the least famous of the planets, at least from the point of view of astronomy in Dante's own time. But he's saying that here, there are some people whose fame perhaps has not reached you, but did a really good job of rule in their own right. And I want to tell you about one of them. So he seems to be changing subjects. He goes from this vast panorama of Roman history, covering the empire in the broadest possible terms, to talking about a particular person who's here who deserves credit as much as he does. It's sort of interesting, in other words, that you have an emperor, sort of the top of the heap on earth, praising somebody else.
And the somebody else has the interesting name of Romeo or Romeo, which literally means someone who's been a pilgrim to Rome. Within this pearl, there also radiates the radiance of Romeo, who accomplished fair, noble deeds that went uncompensated. It's interesting because he turns out to be a court official outside of Italy, a foreigner, if you will, to Dante. He worked for a count named Raymond Berenger, and one of his jobs was to find appropriate husbands for Raymond's four daughters. Dante's going to have a lot to say about the problem of daughters a little bit later on, in fact. Four daughters to marry off. This is tough stuff. Romeo arranged for each one to marry somebody who became a king. How's that for doing a good job?
He did such a great job that his reward was to be kicked out. That is to say, he incurred envy at court and was sort of dismissed and had to spend the rest of his life as a pilgrim. And again, it's important that Justinian tells this part of the story as well, that he's as interested in this as he is in his political successes. Here's what he has to say. When those envious tongues convinced his lord that he should call this just man to account, this man who had rendered him 12 for 10, Romeo, proudly, old and poor, departed. And could the world know what was in his heart as he went begging door to door his bread, though praised today, he would be praised still more. Well, yeah, and of course what's interesting is now that we have heard the story, he is more praised. In other words, through the medium of Dante's own poem, this anonymous life now becomes important. Well, who is this life important to? Why should we want to know about this guy?
For one thing, let's do a brief flashback. Envy at the court was responsible for the dismissal of Pierre Delle Vigne, a story we learn in Inferno 13. He was kicked out of his job because of envy. He blamed envy for it, if you recall. And then he went out and hanged himself. So we have that story in Inferno 13. Here we see the same scenario up to a certain point, and then a radically different ending. How Romeo responded to exile is the important lesson for an about-to-be-exile fella named Dante.
First of all, of course, you've got Pierre responding by suicide. You've got Romeo responding by grace and humility, as Bill says. But it's also interesting to see who's telling the story. The praise of Romeo comes from the emperor. Remember what Pierre's job was. He was the official praisemeister, if you will, spin doctor for Frederick. So that in that story, he's talking about the praise that he offered to his emperor. Here you have praise coming from the emperor to somebody who otherwise would remain anonymous. So that neat reversal tells us a great deal about the difference between Inferno and Paradiso. But of course, both of those stories, the story of Romeo and the story of Pierre, resonate very greatly with the story of the pilgrim who is himself about to go into exile. And as we mentioned when we were looking at Canto 13 of the Inferno, essentially looking at Pierre, it's one of those great examples of Dante seeing a ghost of Christmas future. This is precisely how he is not supposed to act in exile. Here you have the positive example. Here is somebody who loses his place at court, who loses the position that he had held for a long time, and who loses the position that he had done very, very well. And basically he says, win a few, lose a few, and goes out and is a pilgrim on earth. Well, of course, that is the model and the example that Dante ought to be following.
Although we've said that there are a lot of political things in Paradiso, this is sort of the great moment to have this whole discussion of empire. But we're not through yet. It's not that we're now leaving politics for other things. We'll come back to it locally in Florence, and we'll come back to it universally in the words of such people as St. Peter when Dante meets up with him.
Lecture 20, The Circle of the Sun, Saints and Sages.
When Ron was describing the movement that we have in the Paradiso, he pointed out that just as in Inferno 9 we made a big move, and in Purgatorio 9 we made a big move, so is it true with Paradiso 9, where we go outside the shadow the sun casts, so that we are now on the sun, And here we're going to meet those who are associated with wisdom. And it's important because although there's going to be a great collection of scholars, some of the all-time biggies, if you will, we're going to meet here, two things strike us that amend that notion that this is a scholarly place. One is the stories we're going to hear of Francis and Dominic. Neither one of them was really a scholar in any sense of the word at all, especially Francis, of course. And secondly, when we're introduced around by the two major speakers in this part of the paradise, the circle of the sun, we're going to find out there's some real simple folks there as well as learned people. So we need to make sure that while there is indeed a great collection of scholars, wisdom does not equal scholarship. It's a much broader concept that we're going to be examining here in the sun.
And one of the ways that Dante gets at this notion of wisdom is to suggest that it's a kind of cumulative thing and it's a kind of communal thing. That is to say that wisdom has a lot to do with the right relationship of parts and wholes, the way things fit together, so that when we see the scholars, we're introduced to them individually, but they form a circle, a wheel of saved souls. And in fact, we see a second wheel interacting with the first. And so that it's this combination of who these folks are individually and the way that they interact with each other that helps to give us a definition of wisdom. And in fact, what the poet does is start us off heading in that direction by doing exactly the same thing with the very structure of the universe itself. We're out there, as Bill says, we've gone to a new place. He says, okay, here we are outside of the shadow that is cast by the sun on Earth. What do you see? Well, one thing that you do is instead of looking down, you look up. And when you look up, you see, look up with me now, reader, to the spheres, look straight to the point of that lofty wheel where the one motion and the other cross. What he's talking about is the wheel that we would call the equator, that is to say, that line but extended out infinitely into space, and the second wheel, the path of the sun, the yearly path of the sun through the planets, which we call the ecliptic, and that movement is through the sign of the zodiac. And he says, basically, you've got these two wheels that make up the universe, and if you look at them, you see that they cross each other at a certain point. Our way of saying that, of course, in a sort of post-Copernican time would be to say that the Earth is tilted a bit. His way would be to say that the circles out there meet at a 23-degree angle. And he goes on from there to say, this wonderfully intricate mechanism consists of the right relationship between parts and wholes. And if the angle were just a little bit different, life really wouldn't be possible. If the angle were too great, there would be too much of a variation between the seasons. If the angle were too little, there'd be too little variation between the seasons. And so the fact is that you got it just right. And in the creation of the universe, what we're supposed to do, as he says, is revel in the work of that great artist who so loves his art, his gaze on it is fixed perpetually. God contemplates his own creation. We should do that in order for us to become God-like. But notice that what he's saying is that in this depiction of the universe, of the cosmos, there's a reflection in the way in which the two wheels of the souls are presented to us, that they too are a kind of cosmos or a microcosm, if you will, in which wisdom is seen as this wonderful interrelationship of parts and wholes.
Dante comes into contact with this first circle, which consists of 12 souls. By the way, the two circles together obviously add up to 24, a number that has Old Testament resonances and New Testament resonances in the book of Revelation with the 24 elders. The first person who speaks is Thomas Aquinas. Now, it's worth saying something about that. That may seem obvious to us today because if you read histories of medieval philosophy today, it will make it clear that Thomas Aquinas is sort of the greatest of all the medieval or perhaps even all the Christian philosophers at all time. That was not as clear in Dante's time as it is in ours. In fact, some of Thomas Aquinas' teachings were condemned shortly after he died. He really only becomes the dominant theologian of the Catholic Church much later on in the 16th century. So in a sense, Dante, without knowing it perhaps, or without being conscious of it, is being prophetic in having the first speaker here in the Circle of the Sun, where the wise are, being Thomas Aquinas. And Aquinas first introduces Dante to the other 11 folks who were with him. Again, many of them learned people. But they also include, for example, the Old Testament king, Solomon, and there's going to be a long discussion of the wisdom of Solomon a little bit later on. There's an interesting character we meet named Gratian, who is the great compiler of church law. Just as Justinian was, if you will, the one who did Roman law, Gratian was the one who did church law. And what's interesting about that is in just the previous canto, Dante has criticized the church for spending too much time with church law rather than with studying scripture. That does not mean church law is not important. It means that it's being misused for the wrong purposes. So Gratian is here. The most interesting character that Thomas Aquinas introduces us to is a fellow named Siger of Brabant, who turns out in the circle to be right next to Thomas. And Siger was a contemporary of Thomas, and Siger was also in Paris with Thomas Aquinas, and they were, if you will, theologically at odds. Siger not only was condemned as a heretic, but he and Thomas Aquinas disagreed fundamentally on certain issues. We might expect not to find them next to each other in this circle. But in fact, of course, Dante's making a very important claim here about the value of scholarship and also the limits of kind of theological hagglings that take place back on earth, that many of these disagreements are not between bad guys and good guys, but rather people who sometimes erroneously are nevertheless true seekers of wisdom.
It's also interesting that Thomas introduces himself in a very interesting way. He introduces the 12, but not after the other 11, excuse me, but not after he tells us who he is. Humbly and modestly, he says, "I was one of the sacred flock of lambs led by Saint Dominic along the road where all may fatten if they do not stray. This spirit close by me at my right was brother and master to me, Albert of Cologne." So that Siger, it's very interesting, Siger Brabant is on one side because, of course, you get from Thomas Aquinas is sort of one on the circle, Siger is 12, and they're next to each other. But on Thomas's other side is Albert of Cologne, or Albertus Magnus, as he's known now, who was, in fact, Thomas Aquinas' teacher. So that you have this very interesting situation where this the teacher, you know, sort of the guy who played Virgil to Thomas, is there, and then his theological enemy are the two people who are flanking him. But he also says that he was a member of the sacred flock of lambs led by Saint Dominic, which is to say, of course, he was a member of the Dominican order. And then he goes on to say, he led us along the road where all may fatten if they do not stray. Well, this is a line that is not picked up on in this canto. The rest of the canto is Thomas's introduction of all of these sages. But in the following canto, Dante basically wants to find out what he meant by that. What does it mean, all may fatten if they do not stray? And what that does is it leads Aquinas to talk about the problem of reform in the church and the problem of corruption in the church. Because, of course, his own order was founded as a kind of reform order in the church. And so he begins to talk about the original purpose of his order and the other order that was founded at about the same time, that of the Franciscans.
And in fact, he picks up the story this way. "The providence that governs all the world with wisdom so profound none of his creatures can ever hope to see into his depths, in order that the bride of that sweet groom," in other words, the church, "who crying loud espoused her with his blood might go to her beloved made more secure within herself, more faithful to her spouse, ordained two noble princes to assist her on either side, each serving as a guide." That it is no coincidence, there are very few coincidences in this world, there's no coincidence that these two great reformers, Dante's two great reformers of the previous generations, Dominic and Francis, came along at the same time. That the church was in need, and in very different but complementary ways, Francis and Dominic founded orders that addressed the major problems of the church. And in emphasizing the fact that you've got these two together, now I shall speak of only one, Thomas says, for praise of one, no matter which is praise of both, for both their labors served a single end. And what's interesting is that just as he says, I'm going to tell one of the stories, you say, well, he's a Dominican, he's going to tell the story of St. Dominic. In fact, he tells the story of Francis of Assisi.
Now, this becomes in itself one of the exemplifications of the idea of relationship of parts to the whole. Okay, you have the sort of two wheels of the universe. Now you have the two wheels of the chariot, the two orders that were founded. But we have this sort of crisscrossing where Thomas now talks about Francis of Assisi. A little bit later on, it's reversed where we see that Bonaventure, the great Franciscan theologian and philosopher, will tell the story of St. Dominic. But what we have here is, in fact, one of, if not the longest biographies in the entire Commedia, with Thomas Aquinas telling the story of Francis of Assisi. And obviously he thinks this is a very crucial story to get to the heart of what church reform is all about. And obviously he thinks that church reform is very important to get to the heart of what wisdom is all about. That church reform itself is a way of kind of getting your ducks in order, of seeing things in the right relation to each other, which is what the whole sun, the whole cosmos, is all about.
In addition to this sort of universal importance of Francis and his order, the Franciscans, we also have to ask the question, in what way does Francis of Assisi serve as a model for Dante? How can he take away things to learn about for his own life as well as for the church and the empire of which he is a part? And as often happens, on the surface, we'd say, well, not much. That is to say, Francis was an itinerant in a grubby robe who slept in barns and abandoned ovens, who was a member of a religious order with formal vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience. He was a missionary. He went off to the Islamic world. There's all this story about Francis, and you say, yeah, but what does this have to do with this Florentine political figure who was married and had children and was a poet? Why does Francis seem to be such an important model for Dante?
Well, one of the things that we need to realize is that what Francis was all about was to take traditional Christian Catholic spirituality and move it into the city, really. That he was somebody who was responsive to the new urban economy which was developing, and as a kind of spiritual counter to this new economy, preached in particular the virtues of poverty and of humility. Once again, on the surface, it might not seem to have all that much to do with Dante's own particular situation, but we have to remember that one of the things that's coming up very soon is Dante's exile, okay, which means that Francis can be seen as a kind of model for Dante precisely because Francis's poverty is going to be what Dante is going to learn, what Dante is going to need, what Dante is going to have to learn to do is to do without. And so Francis can become a model for him in exile. But also, you'll recall that we spent a lot of time on the Terrace of the Proud when we were dealing with the seven-story mountain. And one of the reasons, as we mentioned, is that that is the most serious of the deadly sins. But Dante himself tells us in a canto immediately after the Circle of the Proud that he's really worried because that's where he's going to have to spend a whole lot of time should he be lucky enough to make it so far. And so there's this sense that by temperament, Dante, a very proud man, is also going to have to learn the Franciscan virtue of humility. So that in a sense, in telling this story, Thomas's wonderful synthesis of who Francis was and what Francis was all about, he is presenting a very important positive model of conduct for Dante the pilgrim.
It's interesting that as he starts to tell the story, it is a kind of highlights reel, although a very personal highlights reel. Somebody else telling Francis a story might have emphasized somewhat different events. But he also starts with a long description of exactly where Francis comes from, describes the city of Assisi and precisely where it's located, and talks about its name and so on. And that may seem sort of odd background when you've got such a compressed situation here in terms of telling Francis' story. But one of the things that I would suggest is, just like you tell the story of Jesus, it starts in the manger. It starts in a place, in a town, in a condition. That what Dante does not want to do here is sort of disembowel the story from its very specific context, because, well, Dante can't do that either. Dante is a Florentine. Wherever he's living, he will remain a Florentine. Florence's history is part of his history. And even though he moves beyond it, just as Francis spends a lot of time way outside of Assisi, he is a person of Assisi. Dante is a person of Florence. You don't sort of move to universal values and truths by suppressing or ignoring the specific situation in which you live. Just as Jesus was born at a particular time and a particular place in history that must continue to be noted, so this is true of Assisi. And what Dante has to figure out is how it's true for him with regard to Florence.
Now, there are a whole bunch of things in Francis's life that are here. As Bill said, it's a great highlight reel. But again, our notion is to see, well, all right, these highlights, why these? And one of them, of course, has to do with the life of Dante himself. Just want to take one particular example. One of the things that Francis does in his life is go to the Sultan, go east during a time of crusade to preach to the Sultan, and hopes himself to gain a kind of martyrdom for that. Okay, it turns out that they liked Francis too much, and that didn't happen. But one of the famous incidents told over and over again in Franciscan lore, presented in a great many different Franciscan paintings, is Francis preaching before the Sultan, and it's mentioned here in the account that Thomas Aquinas gives. Urged by a burning thirst for martyrdom, he preached Christ and his blessed followers in the haughty presence of the Sultan. Now, it seems to me that it's easy to just sort of see that as a part of Francis's lore without necessarily seeing any immediate relevance to Dante. But it turns out that in the next set of cantos, when Dante learns from his great-great-grandfather about his own mission, it turns out that his great-great-grandfather was a crusader and basically says to Dante, your job is to be a kind of crusader too, but to be one with the pen rather than the sword. Your crusade will be the poem that you're going to write, so that Dante is linked to the Crusades just as Francis is here. In other words, this is Francis's way of dealing with the ideology of the Crusade, is to go there as a peaceful and humble man. And so we see that there really is this connection with Dante, even though on the surface it doesn't seem like there necessarily is.
I want to take up another connection, because Francis stripped himself naked before the bishop, leaving behind his father and his family to take on a new life. And Dante uses very interesting language to describe it. Before the bishop's court at Coram Patre, in the presence of his father, he took this lady, we don't actually have a physical woman here, as his lawful wife. From day to day, he loved her more and more. Well, who is this lady? After all, Francis was a celibate member of a religious order. So it turns out the lady is, as Dante identifies her, Lady Poverty. And as Dante says, this is not a very popular bride. That ever since the time of Christ, in fact, she's been pretty much shoved aside, especially in our own day. Francis married Lady Poverty in this image, an image that Dante borrows from some of the early Franciscan lore. And it's very often depicted in art as Francis, with Christ serving as the priest, marrying this woman in tatters, standing in brambles. And therefore, it is the notion that Francis embraced and loved poverty. Poverty may be something for most people that's forced upon them, but they sure hate it. For Francis, poverty is something chosen. He takes a vow of poverty. We learned back in the early cantos of Paradiso that a vow is surrendering part of your freedom of the will as a sacrifice to God. He surrenders any claim on property, his father's property, or anything he might receive in the future. And this poverty, which in Francis's case is a literal poverty, is also something Matthew talks about when he says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Francis is a model not so much for his literal poverty. Dante's not going to literally be a beggar in the street for his daily bread, but Dante has to learn poverty of spirit. And what better model than this very visible, physical model of Francis as the poorest of the poor?
Now, of course, Dante doesn't get to choose the poverty. It is chosen for him, if you will, by the fact of his exile. But I think what the story is saying is that Dante has a choice in how he accepts it. If he accepts it in a Franciscan way, then that becomes part of his mission of taking exile and turning it into a pilgrimage, or, if you will, to use another image, of turning it into a crusade which will result in the Commedia itself. So that it's only by an attitude of acceptance. Again, we can contrast this with what we said about Pierre della Vigna among the suicides, that Dante is going to be able to make that into a kind of meaningful virtue for himself. And so another way in which the story of Francis really becomes a story for Dante to meditate on and to learn from.
I want to suggest another one of these flashbacks like Ron just did that I think will be useful. Oh, unsuspected wealth, oh, fruitful good, Giles throws his shoes off, then Sylvester too. They love the bride so much, they seek the groom. And then this father, this good lord, set out with his dear lady and that family that now was girded with the humble cord. We saw in Inferno 15 how Brunetto Latini used the idea of family in referring to Dante as a son several times in a kind of phony way, as a way of getting around certain problems in his own life. Here we see that family doesn't just literally mean physical procreation, but Francis is fruitful and multiplies. This is a fruitful marriage with Francis and Lady Poverty, with these men named two of them who in fact join up, but then this whole army of the Franciscan order joins. This is very much in contrast to the sterility of the language of family that Brunetto Latini used.
And finally, the story of Francis reaches a kind of climax when Thomas talks about one of the most important of the Franciscan miracles, the reception of the stigmata, Francis actually receiving the wounds of Christ on his own body. It's told in a very interesting way. It's also interesting to think about where Thomas goes for this, because most of his version of Francis's life comes from the story, the biography of Francis that was written by St. Bonaventure, the other one of the masters of ceremony, if you will, for this circle here. So you have Thomas telling Bonaventure's version of Francis and reaching the climax in the story of the stigmatization. It tells him coming back to Italy after being away with the Sultan, and he returned to reap a crop in the Italian fields. Then, on bare rock between Arno and Tiber, he took upon himself Christ's holy wounds, and for 2 years he wore this final seal. Final seal is kind of an interesting pun. It's present in Bonaventure, and Thomas is making use of it. The seal, of course, means that the wounds of Christ are there sort of sealing him, but he's sort of making a little pun because documents were sealed by putting a little red wax on them and stamping them so that they would have, let's say, the papal seal of approval there. And now what we see is that Francis's body is similarly being sealed, but of course the author of this sealing is God himself. So Francis becomes an officially sealed document, or to put it another way, a kind of completed work of art. Back in the parallel cantos of Purgatory, you'll remember, we talked a lot, cantos 10 and 11, the Terrace of the Proud in Purgatory, we talked a lot about how the souls were being formed into works of art by their penance there. And we talked about how we looked at the work of art on the side of the mountain. Here what we have is Francis as completed work of art, and so therefore he becomes a model for others to imitate.
I also want to add one thing on the description of the stigmatization that Thomas Aquinas gives here. The stigmatization took place at a place called Laverna, which is in the modern province of Arezzo in Tuscany. But he describes it on the bare rock between the Arno and the Tiber. As it turns out, Laverna is not very far from the origin of the Tiber and not very far from the origin of the Arno River. One, of course, flows to Rome, center of the world, center of empire and papacy. The other flows to Florence, home of Dante. This is another one of those ways in which we see the personal and the universal coming together. Francis is a universal figure for the church. The Tiber flows to Rome. Francis is a personal model for Dante. The Arno flows to Florence.
We move from Thomas's description of Francis to Bonaventure's life of Dominic. And again, a parallel here, the crossover, the Franciscan theologian philosopher talking about the Dominican founder. And even though the life of Dominic was perhaps not as famous or as popular as the life of Francis, it was nonetheless important, and Bonaventure does a good job of presenting it in its details.
As Ron said, that life is not now or then nearly as well known, but it takes up about the same amount of lines, if you will. And what we would want to emphasize here, since we don't have time to go into the life in great detail, is its complementarity to the life of Francis. Francis was a guy who went around and preached to people and told them to come back to God. He preached repentance, and what he emphasized is that Christianity's got to be more than something you do on Sunday morning. It's got to be a way you live your life. You've got to experience Christ, not simply know things about his life. Dominic and his order emphasized the importance of correct doctrine. And this is an important thing. Today, I think for a lot of people, including a lot of Christians, doctrine doesn't seem to be very important. Dante did believe, medieval theologians believed, that if you got doctrine wrong, only wrong things could flow from that. And so Thomas went around to correct Thomas and the founder of the order, Dominic, went around to correct the errors of the day, more intellectual sense of preaching, a more learned kind of preaching. Francis and his followers went around saying, come back and repent. You need both, that both of these are important parts of what the church needed to be renewed.
And notice, of course, that needing both is highlighted, emphasized by the fact that it is the Dominican who tells the story of the Franciscan who tells the story of the Dominican. And Bonaventure, after he has given the life of Dominic, then introduces the sages who are part of his wheel, the second complementary wheel that is in tandem with the first. And it's interesting that in exactly the same way, he sort of goes around and mentions all of these folks, and when he gets to the end, there's a surprising figure. He mentions somebody, says at the very end there, here at my side shines the Calabrian abbot Joachim, who had received the gift of prophecy. This is Joachim of Fiore, very interesting figure in medieval theology and history, essentially somebody who was, like Siger of Brabant in Thomas's version, kind of at the fringes of things and sort of skirting the border of heresy because of fairly radical things that he seemed to say about Christian history and his study of Christian history. And Bonaventure was somebody who rejected what he saw as excesses in Joachim, and in particular the followers of Joachim. But here, at the very end, what you have is Bonaventure and Joachim together, possible, indeed, actual rivals on earth, but now part of the larger whole when they are present in the wheel of the sages in the circle of the sun.
It's also interesting that at the end of Thomas's life of Francis, Thomas denounces some of the Dominicans, not Franciscans, Dominicans, goes back to his own order of his day, and Bonaventure does the same with the Franciscans. This is something else that Dante has to learn. It's really easy to criticize the other guys. What Dante sees here is Thomas Aquinas criticizing something he loves, the Dominicans. Bonaventure criticizing something he loves, his own order, the Franciscans. And so that, too, is an important lesson for Dante, the poet, who's going to go back and write this Commedia.
Lecture 21, A Mission Revealed, Encounter with an Ancestor.
One of the constant themes in these lectures has been the alternation between the public and the private. For example, in the last lecture, we were in the circle of the sun, and there Dante meets the great sages of the biblical Christian tradition, and the masters of ceremony for that circle for Dante are Thomas Aquinas and Bonaventure, both of whom have remained as kind of examples of Christian philosopher theologians. So they have a kind of public fame that has continued from Dante's time until our own. But in the next circle, Dante's next stop in his celestial voyage, he encounters a figure who has a much more private kind of resonance with him. He meets his own great-great-grandfather, a person named Cacciaguida. We're in the circle